And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back to another edition of Chatter on Books.
Officially the new year now.
It is officially the new year, yes. I guess our last episode was New Year's Eve, wasn't it?
Yes, we made it.
And now we are back here. We're doing a show leading up to the National College Football Championship.
And the Tony Korn has a show.
Tony Korn has a show,
quite
yes.
a few people contacted me today and said, oh, are you guys like the regular lead-in for Tony's show?
That's
now?
Right. Yeah, we're the opening act.
That's an honorable place to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all.
Nothing preps you better for college football than Chatter on Books.
That's right.
Exactly.
There's a lot of crossover there.
We have a very exciting show.
We do, and we are thrilled to have with us, it's a big crowd here up in the studio, David and
people
Jeannie,
up in this piece, as well.
And
like
Michael and Carol and Rob, and Rob's our official bartender for this evening. And a little while from now, Ron is going to bring in our beer of the evening. We're
going to
mix it up.
Beer.
Sometimes the wine of the evening, sometimes the beer of the evening. And speaking of beer, what we have on tap this evening is we've got a few fun, in my opinion, a few fun segments to start out with. Hey, 19, what kind of people should be and should not be writing books this year and beyond? New Year's babies. Michael was just saying before the show, January seems to be a very interesting month for the birth of many famous authors. Talk a little bit about them. Clash of the Critics. There is a great new website out. It's the Rotten Tomatoes of Books called Book Reviews. And what they do is they collate and curate a lot of reviews about important, new, interesting books. And you can read what people you know, some people you don't know, are saying about books. Our author of the week coming in soon is Cokie Roberts, who is just a freaking legend. Mm-hmm. And I thought I knew, I've known Cokie Roberts for years. I thought I knew a lot about her. I lost track of the awards, of the number of books, of the things she's done, of her family history. So we'll have her out here in a little bit. And, of course, the increasingly crowded deserted island recommendations.
Right. It's a big library on that island. Exactly.
It's a very, very big library. We're going to have to start getting shelves.
Exactly. Build them out of coconut. Come on. You see
Amazon.
It's
going to have to get
we
in
need
there.
Somebody, we need a Dewey Decimal System there.
Well, I have already, I don't know about Mark or David, Jeannie maybe, but I have already started to get some emails and some tweets from people saying, hey, we heard so-and-so talking about a book. We heard Jeannie recommend a book. And I picked it up. I never would have. I loved that one. Or Michael was talking about a book that was too smart for the rest of you knuckleheads. But I went and got it, and I really liked it. So it's a really interesting thing, and who knows what the intent of this show is? I certainly don't. But if it causes people to pick up
wine.
Something else, you have to drink wine and drink beer. If it causes them to pick up something they might not have otherwise read, I think that's
that.
A great thing.
I think that's great.
I absolutely love that. Housekeeping, Chatter on Books, Twitter, follow us, download us, review us. Please, 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 please. And I threw out on the tables out there, and we'll throw out more. We have cute postcards now. Chatter on Books postcards.
Look at this. We're all
which
so when you're on the deserted island, you can send us a postcard from there.
Exactly. I think it'll only be a 50-cent stamp.
And then when it comes back, you'll know where you are.
Exactly.
It'll come back in a bottle.
Have we determined that deserted island is actually Teddy Roosevelt Island?
Yeah, which is deserted.
Was that the picture in the paper day of people who were climbing over the fence?
Yes.
Have you been to Teddy Roosevelt Island? It's not worth the climb. It's really not worth the climb.
I think it's popular with dog walkers.
Yes.
Okay. Kind of a trek. Okay, 2019, who should be and who should not be writing books this year? And I'm going to go first because mine are really fast.
Okay.
Madison Kelly, I know, who recently, God bless them, just left the White House, are probably thinking, and I'm sure millions of people are saying to them, you need to write a book, you need to tell all of these things. Thanks, Ron, our beer.
That is beer.
Now look at that.
That's some beer.
Tall boys.
And I'm sure they're thinking about it because I don't know them well, but I'm guessing neither one of them has a lot of money socked away, and I really hope they don't do it. I don't know Kelly at all. I sort of knew Mattis. I really like him. I really respect him. I think putting a lot of time, a lot of distance between what has happened and when they might write books could be a very useful thing. So I hope they don't. And David, maybe you can help on this. One of my future trophy husbands, Steve Kerr, I think should write a book.
Yeah.
Right?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yeah. Okay, hold on. I'm going to text
Steve
Kerr.
Send him
a text. Steve Kerr right now.
Exactly.
Tell him that Tori Clark wants to be your trophy.
I told you. I tried to get him as a speaker, and shockingly, my German colleagues were not as interested in Steve Kerr as I was, but he has an amazing personal story. He seems like a really good guy.
He seems
very thoughtful. He dips into cultural issues selectively, and I think very smartly. And I think right now in current environment, we need smart people saying smart, sound things. So I think he should write a book.
You think I'm kidding? I'm actually texting him right now.
he can be on the show. Tell him it's a twofer. He can be my future trophy husband and be on the show.
How can he turn that down?
Exactly. Okay, Mark, who should write? Who shouldn't write?
I think Colin Kaepernick should write a book.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He hasn't written one yet.
There you go.
And maybe he has held off because he still wants to play.
I think he still wants to play.
No, I definitely think he still wants to play. But maybe he looks at this and says, you know what? Maybe that ship has sailed. They're not gonna, you know, let me back on the field for whatever reason, and let me tell my story. Yeah. I think it'd be a huge, huge seller. I'd love to hear things from his perspective, from the whole way through it.
He'd have to work with the right kind of person to help write it. And yes. I don't mean that because he can't write. He may be very capable, but to keep the right kind of perspective. Mm-hmm. But I think it could be really, really useful. Just coming off 2 or 3 weeks of the holiday scene, and we've got a lot of friends who still have younger kids who are playing sports, they see him as a role model.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
See him as a role model, right? These people in Chevy Chase whose 10-year-old white kid still thinks they're going to play in the NBA someday, right? And think they would do anything to play. For him to have sacrificed what he sacrificed for his beliefs, they think is pretty admirable.
And finding the right person to partner with him so this can be forward-thinking, because I think there's a lot of area to explore as to what he wants to do next, particularly with the power that he's been given through this contract with Nike. And there's a lot of space to move into being an influencer that's beyond anything you say, you know, in front of a camera, on the field, and how you can direct social change from those 10-year-olds up, how they're going to carry sort of the shoes, the outerwear, the T-shirts. All that branding is a really powerful space for him.
Yeah, I agree. So, Michael, who should write? Who shouldn't write?
This is going to seem really small when you first hear it. So
nothing from
my
you
background
small, Michael.
Is with golf, but I would love to see something from Patrick Reed, the most talked about and hated golfer of 2018.
Great one. Oh, yeah.
So he is coming off of the biggest victory of his career, the Masters, and this is not an open championship. This is a tournament, and he has been at basically butting heads with his entire group of contemporaries. We saw this really taking shape at the Ryder Cup. Since then, he's been mentored by Tiger Woods. Other than Tiger, he's one of the only golfers to break through to the mainstream TMZ, People Magazine sort of attention. And if you go back to the college days, to the junior golf days, where there are the stories of cheating, stories of theft,
his own teammates hating him, right?
Correct.
In college.
Right.
Yeah.
Had to go through two different teams, won a national championship, still the most hated player. And this is, imagine just the stories. Every year, Azalea's starting to bloom. You're coming back for that Masters champion dinner. And there's Jordan Spieth sitting next to his dear old friend, Patrick.
I hope they have assigned seating at that, because if not, nobody would sit next to him.
Would Jordan Spieth write the forward?
Forward.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't read this book and I hate him.
And he's particularly knowledgeable about the Masters course, right? About Augusta, yeah.
Would it be called My Way or something?
Oh, gosh. And it would be a great psychological look at the mindset of an individual athlete, because he relishes in this role. He wants to be not just Captain America, but he wants the hatred of the other players because he feeds off that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that would be a fascinating book. I'm fascinated by the psychology of golfers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you think, I remember talking once when I was at Comcast and they took on Golf Channel. And I talked to some of the golfers and the managers and the golf shrinks and things like that. And they talked about how they have to have, and Michael, you know this, you just have to have ice in your veins. And you can never show or have any emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what kind of shot you took, you never think about it again. You're on to the next one. And one of the reasons the television people love Tiger so much, other than the obvious, was he was one of the first who acted like an athlete.
That's right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Pumping fist and yelling. Mm-hmm. And they loved him because of that. And Patrick Reed is more like that. Oh, I think it'd be great. Okay, Jeannie?
Oh, okay. So I would like to read a book by Maria Butina, the redheaded Russian spy.
Awesome. Her days at American University. Yeah. Awesome.
A fellow alumna of American
That's
University.
Correct.
Exactly how like far back she goes and what she... I mean, again, if it's an honest book, I would love to read one. But who knows? She may have nothing left to lose and would be happy.
I'm pretty sure there's a dude named Vlad who would have the say-so whether that book gets written or not.
She's not going to be able to go back to the home country anyway.
Right.
So,
it's not going to go well.
She may as well buy into capitalism and write a tell-all book. And the other one I really want, if he would write an honest book, is Lorne Michaels, who has seen our generation and the next generation of comic talent go through his studio, go through his doors. I mean, talk about herding elephants. He has had to hurt. I've been there, but not the elephants that are as big as his elephants.
Right. And you think about how long that show has been on.
44 years.
And seeing the changing standards of comedy, what's acceptable, what's pushing the envelope, where you get laughs as you move from sort of into this digital age where you sort of think a show like that wouldn't really have a place anymore.
Right.
And how you began to, you know, acknowledge diversity, bring on Eddie Murphy.
Does everybody here remember the first time they saw Saturday Night Live?
Sure.
Jeannie, who was the first one? What was the first one? Who was the host or the music?
Oh, that I don't remember. I mean, I remember the original cast, but I could not tell you the original host or music.
I came in from some party one night with my friend Lisa Baker, and we just turned on the television, the show we had never seen before, and Simon and Garfunkel were singing Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Is that right?
I remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
That's better than my first memory of that show with the Spice Girls.
A little later.
Same thing.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same thing.
Michael, isn't it past your bedtime? David?
Well, the person who should write a book is Serena Williams.
Oh, yeah.
I'm shocked she hasn't.
Yeah, me too.
Me too.
Why hasn't she?
I don't know. I know Venus has written books of sorts. I think they've written books of sorts, but not the book, not the autobiography, not
the
good stuff.
She must be thinking about it.
I'm sure she is, and I think she would have an incredible story to tell about.
What would be the most interesting parts of her story?
To me, it would be watching. She has seen a real significant swath, and she had a lot to do with it, along with her sister, of the real, I think, empowerment of female athletes on an equal playing field with male athletes. You know, it was something that obviously Billie Jean King was the person who got that going, who was the catalyst for that happening, but that was always a struggle for Billie Jean King and the athletes of her generation. They were always fighting for more.
Right.
Well, Serena basically said, no, I'm getting more. You're going to give it to me or I'm not playing. And they had to give it to her because she delivered ratings and all of the interest and buzz and everything. And so I think she can speak from a very different place than almost any athlete, period, but certainly almost any female athlete who's ever played, about kind of what it's like to accept as a matter of natural consequence that you would be paid the exact same amount as men, that you would be treated the exact same way male athletes are treated. And if that was something that was organic with her, or if that was something that was instilled in her, you know, obviously growing up in Compton and her father and all of that
father's
is
crazy,
fascinating.
Right?
He's crazy in a way that he developed world champion tennis
players. And like Tiger Woods' his father, in a way.
Well, driven.
But not, I was going to say a lot. But we all know certain parents, Tiger Stat, who can develop fantastic athletes on the field.
Yeah.
But often then they screw up their lives. Read Andre Agassi's autobiography.
Right.
I remember starting to follow Serena and Venus when they were quite young, because my friend Jamie Sterling had overly obsessive, you're too old for this obsession with them when they first start playing tennis, and reading about them and seeing the interviews with the dad going, he's nuts. And the fact that they still ended up, they both seem very squared away.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing, and all credit to Earl Woods for, you know, helping to create a champion in Tiger Woods, but Rich Williams, two black women became world champions. Right. You know, I mean, that's just, wow. You know, that's really with no particular formal training as a coach.
And
I mean,
also to his credit, the dynamic between them. Yes. And they were often competitors. Yes. And that doesn't seem to have affected their relationship.
So you're right, Tori. I think he was crazy, but the things he was crazy about were not about them, you know, and making them into great champions. Because he did that part he got way right now as a person, as a husband, you know. No.
Jeannie, that's a really interesting point. My three oldest sisters were very close in age, very good tennis players, as in top of the charts in Western Pennsylvania, college, varsity, et cetera. And they almost killed each other sometimes because they would end up playing against one another. They had to play doubles, and of course, it was always the other one's fault, kind of thing. That's really, and they're still incredibly supportive of one another.
Yeah.
I don't know which finals it was, but they were playing in some finals once, and they were playing each other. And they're being interviewed ahead of time saying this is the hardest thing ever to have to do this.
Yeah, to find that edge.
All right, any of those people, if they write books in 2019 or beyond, they have to be on our show first.
Yes, we
came up with that.
Yeah.
Somebody, of all of these, which do we think is most likely?
A book?
Colin Kaepernick, Patrick Reed, Serena Williams.
I've seen Colin Kaepernick.
I could see Kaepernick writing a book. Yeah, because he knows he's never going to play again, so... There's nothing to lose.
Do you think he knows that?
Oh, yeah.
Like, at this point, he has to, doesn't he?
I mean, if they're picking up Mark Sanchez before Colin Kaepernick, come on.
What's Mark doing this weekend?
He's not writing a book.
He's not playing football.
Carrying a clipboard, just practicing for next year.
Yeah. God. Yeah, so I could see Kaepernick, and there would be a lot of people, me included, who would love to write a book with him.
Okay.
I told you I want to write books.
We can get this done. Okay. But
Colin, who listens to this show.
There you go.
So there you go. Yeah.
Frequent
listener.
Yeah.
I just want to point out, I was a fan of his way back when. David, can you reach behind you, or Jeannie?
Oh, beer.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, Jeannie, do you mind making this your job? David and I will drink. You may discuss.
Pop the top.
Not a bit.
Sometimes we do wine of the evening.
Pop the top.
The beer of the week at Chatter and Books is, this is not a 22-ounce bottle. It's by Schmaltz.
Schmaltz, is that real?
Schmaltz. I don't know if an Irish Catholic is saying that appropriately. But... it's Jubilatious 21. Okay. Again, this is like an Irish Catholic trying to say
chaputzpah.
Because he doesn't have the chaputzpah to do it.
Yeah, it's a dark ale, and I'm not a beer drinker. So, Tori, you have just tasted it.
It's quite good. I am a beer drinker.
Tori, what's the ABV?
I'm all over this thing.
There you go.
I never know the words. Michael, help us with the words. We're supposed to be looking for...
Oh, that's good.
Isn't it good?
Oh,
it goes down very easily.
It's okay.
It's 11% alcohol, which is a lot for beer.
Would you?
So Tori will be getting rolled out of here.
Yeah,
half an hour, 45 minutes. It's dark.
Yeah, it's quite good.
Yeah, and it's the death of the 22-ounce bottle. And there's a lot of writing on the side.
It's way too much words. Stop with the words.
Something about Northern California in 1986, but it's really
too
good.
Too many words. But a very good beer.
Thank you very much. We'll do more of those. Okay.
That's outstanding.
January's nice start to the year. Okay, January babies.
Ah, yes.
The ones I found, and Michael found some too, famous authors born in January. J.R.R. Tolkien. Who knows, by the way what J.R.R. stands for?
Jimmy Roy Ray.
Mass murderer. Mass murderer.
He was from Mobile, wasn't he?
Children buried under his front porch, for sure.
Just degrees he earned along the way.
Yeah. John Ronald Ruel. I don't know how to pronounce this. Ruel, R-E-U-E-L, is what J.R.R. stands for. Carl Sandburg. And Jack London were all born in January. So Tolkien, The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, The Silmarillion. Carl Sandburg, who knew? 3 Pulitzers. 2 for poetry, 1 for a book on Abraham Lincoln. Correct. Who knew?
How many Pulitzers?
3.
That's 3.
3.
It's a bit selfish, isn't it? It's all about me.
Well, after the first two, then you say, I just want to throw my name in.
Yeah, exactly.
Give it to some of the other children.
Elected, I will not serve.
Exactly.
And
Carl.
Jack London, who knew? He died quite young.
Named the square after him.
Call of the Wild, Martin Eden. Between 1900 and 1916, Jack London wrote more than 50 fiction and nonfiction books.
He was
of short stories.
Oh, he was a writing machine.
Yeah. Total writing machine. So I don't know what January is all about.
When you think of silent free reading as an elementary school kid,
What the heck is silent free reading?
Well, you had, say, after lunch, you were too old for a nap, but they still wanted to give you a quiet space. I just remember seeing those Jack London books.
Ah.
I haven't picked one up in probably 25
years. With the dog
years.
On the front?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just great.
White Fang.
Yeah.
I read Call of the Wild.
I'm sure you did.
I think it was back in the day, because we're all sort of the same age.
Except for Michael.
Thank you.
No, I consider you to be the same age. Is that still required reading? Is that part of the canon anymore?
I could not tell you. Honestly, these are just when I think back to those days. These were some of the books that got young boys into reading.
Yeah. Oh, young girls, too.
I love those books.
Absolutely.
And I actually read a lot of Jack London.
So they're all kind of different, but of those three, who had the greatest impact?
Well, for me, I would say Jack London. I mean,
do you think so?
Yes, just because of that sort of wild nature perspective. Yeah. But I don't know anybody else who he was writing in like 1902, 1903,
sure.
1904.
So yeah, didn't he cover the San Francisco earthquake for the San Francisco Chronicle or something like that?
That could well
and
be.
And did march with the there were a bunch of unemployed, I'll call them bums because I think that's what he calls them in the book, the road where they marched on Washington and he just went with them all the way across. I mean, he did all kinds of different writing.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I think Tolkien, because of the whole Hobbit, Fellowship of the Ring, all that stuff. I mean, don't you think?
I tried to look up, okay, who are the modern day Jack London, Sandbergs, et cetera. And by the way, can we talk poetry? Come on. It's like jazz. Come on.
It's the notes you don't hear.
Hey. You're going to keep fighting about jazz.
There are exceptions.
We're fighting, Tori.
Wait a minute.
I basically agree with you, although I'm sure there are exceptions.
I'm going to take you to Blues Alley, and you're going to go to jazz.
Oh, no.
I used
to go to Blues Alley. I used to date a guy that went to Blues Alley all the time. And I swear to God, he wore a beret occasionally. He really did.
I have no berets, but there's good jazz.
There is good
jazz.
Really is.
And poetry.
You have to work at it.
It's the greatest stuff in the world. And I had this argument with a lit professor I had, and we started reading Jane Austen, and he's like, and all these poets from this, they're all crap. This is Wordsworth.
Okay.
This is Coleridge.
Okay,
these
try.
Guys are giants.
Xanadu, the Kubla Khan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stanley Clutch.
Water everywhere.
And Yeats. I should have, oh, no, yeah, that's Eliot. I should have been a ragged pair of claws getting across
you
the
You all come
the
up
sides.
With one line.
No,
that's all I'm saying.
Tennessee?
No, I know the whole Kubla Khan thing. I'd like
go.
To.
Go.
Xanadu, the Kubla Khan, the saintly pleasure dome decree, where off the sacred river ran, past the caverns, measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. That's all
right.
Nicely
done.
Yeah, no, poetry's the best stuff.
Okay.
Love poetry.
Still love the end of Ulysses. The much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
I like
that. Wow. The bar has been raised.
Wow. Very good.
And what's the one, I'm the captain of my soul? It's a beautiful poem.
I guess I shouldn't do my little Willy poem.
I'm the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem.
The one line that everyone remembers, it's always from Paradise Lost, Book 1. Arise, awake, or be forever fallen. Or the one that really annoys you is
that
someone... The mind is its own self, or the mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven.
Wow. Or you could do the shortest poem in the world, which was written by Muhammad Ali. Me? Wee!
By the way, he was another January birthday.
Yes.
Muhammad Ali was?
Yeah.
Can
I? That's
so these three birthdays, all from the first week of January. Zora Neale Hurston.
Yep.
About that.
1-7. Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Yeah.
An amazing story about finding your voice. And as powerful as it is for the African American experience, just a female finding her voice against three different husbands is fantastic. Umberto Eco, the Italian scholar. Do you remember the name of the rose?
Mm-hmm.
That'll actually be one of my Desert Island books to read.
Good.
Okay.
And J.D. Salinger.
Wow. This is wow.
Now, what did he ever do?
He
Virginia Woolf, also.
January, really?
Yeah, January 25th, 1882.
This is amazing.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I
and Elvis,
what was going on.
Elvis, not that he's a writer, but he was a writer of. Actually, I don't think he wrote many of his songs.
No, he was an interpreter / stealer.
Exactly.
I'm going to appropriate all of this. Yeah. But it's a king, man.
But he was very good.
He was very good.
Yeah.
And Alexander Hamilton, who wrote a famous musical
about himself.
He left it in a vault so that all of us could enjoy it today.
Still just not throwing away a shot.
Have you guys have all seen Hamilton, right?
Yes.
Has everybody in this room seen Hamilton?
Yes.
I'm the only one that hasn't seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you could do it.
Gotta fix that.
Gotta see that, right?
It's beyond bucket list.
It's
beyond bucket list because it's not just a really good musical.
Yeah.
It's not. It's just. It's something very, very different.
Yeah, it broke the mold.
Yeah.
It's a piece of literature. I mean, and I mean that in the sense, comparing it to any classical book or poem or anything, it's a piece of literature
with so many genres within it.
It's
That's what I loved about it.
Yes,
and I listened to that album 400 or 500 times before I saw the show, and
oh, wow.
it was still.
And you still were on the edge of like captivated.
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
And
that's the highest compliment you can pay.
As I said once, probably on Tony's show, I have a little friend, she's now 12 or 13, in Warrenton, Virginia. I never left Warrenton, Virginia in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She can sing every lyric from the show. She knows what they mean.
Yeah,
and I promise you, when I was 11 or 12, I had no idea who Alexander Hamilton
right.
was or what the Federalist Papers were. And then my dad was 95 when we took him. He loved it. Two completely opposite ends of the spectrum.
There's a great service online. It's now called Genius. When it started, it was Rap Genius, and it was a space where you could annotate in a digital way famous rap songs, and then it branched out into poetry, and it continued that genre. But Hamilton and the soundtrack is a great place to get lost into looking at some of those small throwaway lines, because the show does such a great job of tracing these little motifs and refrains throughout the entire piece. But it's a great way to see what scholars and listeners just like yourselves are seeing.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Somebody was just saying the other day, they took a line, what are the odds that the gods would put us all in one place mm-hmm. at this time?
Yeah.
And it was a conversation about how these things are just working their way into the vocabulary. Cokie Roberts is here.
Oh,
a star is here. Hi, Cokie. Yeah. Okay, we've got one more thing to do, Cokie, and then we'll bring you over.
Mm-hmm.
What was my one more thing? Okay, so Clash of the Critics. So check out this website, Books Review. It's the Rotten Tomatoes of books. It's really fun because just in one place, if you've heard about a book and go, do I really want to read Educated by Tara Westover? And then you'll get 5-10 different reviews, and you can kind of go through it. It's not as harsh as Rotten Tomatoes, but it's pretty useful. But I picked one. I picked up what they were saying about Woodward's book, Fear, which we all know about.
Sure.
We've all heard so much about, and we've seen so many reviews of, we feel like we don't need to read it. And two people we all know, Jill Abramson and Tim Weiner, both reviewed it. And I was talking to Jeannie about this the other day. The thing I found interesting is they took the opposite side of something but used the same substance, and they were talking about what he does with facts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read Jill Abramson first. His utter devotion to just the facts digging and his compulsively thorough interviews preserved on tape for this book make him a reliable narrator. In an age of alternative facts and corrosive tweets about fake news, Woodward is truth's gold standard. And then she goes on essentially in that theme. Tim says, Woodward is a fantastic fact finder who cannot and will not analyze the facts he finds. And since he refrains from judging what his sources say, he runs the risk of becoming their prisoner and, at worst, a stenographer to power. Who got it right? Michael?
I'm sorry. It takes me a little while to think through this. At first blush, I think through the second reviewer just because I think right now we're asking journalists, we're asking those fact finders to not only find, collect, collate, put it out in a cohesive and a manageable way, but to also tell us how to interpret it, which I think is really the first time that we're putting those expectations into that journalist. So I appreciate that second review. So I'd have to go there.
Okay. Jeannie?
So I know Bob Woodward, so let me preface this discussion by saying that, and I don't know Tim. When you buy a Bob Woodward book, you know exactly what you are getting. You're not getting Truman Capote. You're not getting Joan Didion. You're not getting creative nonfiction. You're getting nonfiction. And when I watch Woodward now on talk shows, he is such a pillar of fact and not conspiracy or theory. And he's odd man out. I mean, I think they're kind of sick of him because he holds his ground there about fact. And I think that some of the vulnerability today of the press is because there are people who are, quote, interpreting the facts. And I believe that Woodward is pure in his putting the facts out, and you read them and you think what you think. And he does not, he never writes op-ed pieces. He never writes perspective pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So when I buy a Bob Woodward book, I know exactly what I'm getting. And so I would go with Jill Abramson's review.
I love this. David? Tiebreaker, David.
There's four of us here. Could still be. Well, no, actually, we'll.
No, I had to recuse myself.
Yeah. You have to. Oh, that's right.
I just have a Woodward story because that's all I do is tell stories.
It can't beat my pony story. So good luck.
That's a great point.
My preface is by saying I worked with Bob Woodward in the same building, but we were not at all colleagues. And the one time I said, "Oh, hi, Bob," he looked at me like I would like it. Hit him with a shovel.
So Mr. Woodward
he's
to
not
you.
That way. He really is a very
Bobby.
Nice. A very nice
Bobby,
guy.
What'd you think of the game last night?
We were colleagues for 10 years. No? Nothing? No? Okay. He is a.
And take this to what you and I we were trading.
Yeah, no, well, I will do that. he is a colossally important journalist in our time. I you know, I would not be in this business if not for Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. I wouldn't have done it.
Tony too, right, Michael?
Yeah.
Hasn't he said that? Yeah.
When I was, and I people think I'm crazy, but I'm not. I read every story that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein wrote in the Washington Post when I was 8 years old. I read every single story in this in 1973. It was that important to me. I thought, my...
Such a nerd, weren't
I
you?
Was a complete
yeah.
nerd.
Yeah.
Cool,
yeah.
God.
That's awesome. Oh, the nerdiest nerd in Nerdville. So the things that he's done, the stories that he... The books that he's written are the accounts of what actually happened in these various White Houses over the last 40 years now. And that is consequential. That is incredibly consequential. Having said that, I think that... You run the risk when you assure people of anonymity, you run the risk of their version of history becoming the version of history. You cannot read All the President's Men, you cannot read The Final Days without acknowledging that whether it was Alexander Haig or Henry Kissinger or both, the cooperation they gave in those books made them look like the heroes of
right.
those books.
Right.
Although I would say in Bob's defense that although there are lots of anonymous sources, mm-hmm. they are always in the perspective of other anonymous sources
right.
who say, no, that's not how it went down, or yes, it is how it went down, that he's always playing that one against another.
Is that to a certain degree. I've read The Final Days of the 100 times, and it's because it's a great book. It is a great mm-hmm. book, but it just comes across. He did not talk to Nixon. Let's put it that way.
And he didn't talk to Trump.
You know, he didn't talk to Nixon.
Right.
He didn't talk to Trump. So the people that he did talk to can kind of shape the narrative
yes.
in the way that's fit for them. I think you run the risk when you do it that way. And it's to the credit of all journalists that he plays it right down the middle. That he doesn't take sides. That he says, look, this is what happened on this Tuesday and this is what the temperature was and all of those Woodward things that we all kind of make fun of. It's all to the good, but you do run the risk of being manipulated by the people who give you the most access and the most information.
I'm not going to vote here, but I'm just going to tell one quick story, and then we're going to bring Cokie over, because that's the real reason people are listening to this
Absolutely.
Podcast.
Absolutely.
Having been on the receiving end and working with people who have been on the receiving end or engaged in Woodward books, if you don't play, you pay.
Mm.
And one of the critiques of this book, which often happens with his books, is Mueller, of course, did not cooperate. Mueller and his people are not talking to anyone, and they come out badly in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely true. And when he decided to write the first book on the Bush 43, his first book on the Bush 43 administration, somebody, Karen Hughes or something like that from the White House, called me up and said, hey, Woodward's doing the book. We're going to cooperate. You got to get Rumsfeld to sit down and talk with him. I said, well, that's going to be a fun conversation. And I went in to see Rumsfeld, and I said, Woodward's doing this book. Yeah, I don't want to talk to him. Well, you kind of have to. No, I'm not going to. And I said, well, you kind of have to. And he says, no, I'm not. So I went to the outer office, and I borrowed an assistant's phone, and I called Karen, and I said, well, he doesn't want to do it. And she goes, hold on. She clearly walks over to the president. The president calls Rumsfeld and says, I'm cooperating with him. You can talk to him.
Right.
So Woodward comes over with Dan Balz, as a matter of fact. And well before this, we had started a thing at the Pentagon. Whenever Rumsfeld or any senior person did an interview of any kind, we would record the whole thing. We would transcribe the whole thing. And then once the story had appeared, whether it was in print or on television, we would post on the DOD website the entire transcript.
Right.
Smart.
And before, originally, we started out doing it because I said, God, we have these senior officials preparing and sitting down and spending hours in these interviews, then it might turn out to be a, 500-word story. It's just
right.
not
right.
worth it, right? And at first, some of the journalists really hated it, but they came to like it because
right.
their stuff got even more play.
Right.
But when Woodward comes in for his first interview with Rumsfeld, and he and Dan sit down and we're talking, and my guy Brian Whitman and I are sitting there, and we put out a little tape recorder, since whatever. And Rumsfeld said, "Well, since this is a book, when are we going to post the transcript?" Woodward's head snaps around, almost falls off his shoulders, and says, "What?" And I said, "Oh yeah, this is what we do." And, we can't have that. And I said, "Well, then we're not going to have this interview."
Yeah.
And he was shocked and stunned. And so it is a little bit funny now, one of the things he's saying with this book is about he's got all these tape recordings, can back up everything that is in his book. But my favorite Bob Woodward story is that I think it's page 233. I'm not sure in that book. I get a brief mention.
Hey, how about that?
I have a very brief mention, and what's really interesting is he refers to me as Victoria A. Clark. And what's really interesting about that is not only is my middle initial not A, I don't have a middle initial.
Really?
Makes you think everything at Watergate might have been made up.
Right. Exactly. Completely. Yeah. I'm the youngest of five girls.
My dad didn't have a middle initial.
By the time my parents got to me, they had run out of girls' names.
Hey,
so I had flat out.
Well, you should make one up.
Harry Aloysius.
Harry S. Truman.
Yeah, Harry Truman, that's right. Just the S. It's a placeholder.
Hi, it's Cokie
Roberts
here.
Is with us.
Cokie Roberts is here.
Great to be with you. I must say, I did read this last Woodward book.
God bless you.
And I know. I actually listened to it.
Did he do it? I'm sorry, I don't even know.
But I would have to take a little issue with not taking sides. The last sentence, after all, is the president is a liar. That is the last sentence of the book. So I rest my case.
Seems a little ambiguous, doesn't it?
I don't know if that's taking
be
sides.
Why
as opposed to stating a...
So
that's my opinion. That's one thing.
How are you guys?
We are always
happy to see you.
You're nice so nice to be
you.
With us right
well,
after the holidays.
You gave me a nice glass of
You're
wine. It's
good.
Excellent.
You know, good.
First of many, if you like.
That's
what we do here.
So, Cokie, before you got here, I was talking, saying I've known you forever.
I know.
The absolute best person with whom you want to sit in a green room before taping this week with George or whomever, and all the other knuckleheads in the green room are sitting there taking notes and being all just
nerdy.
Persnickety and nerdy. And she and I are like, what are you making for Thanksgiving?
Right.
Yeah. We go to a food conversation.
Even better is the makeup room.
The best. The absolute best. I've always said there should be a fabulous television show, a sitcom, called The Makeup Room. The best conversations.
Well, not only that, from a female journalist point of view, the men are so vulnerable at that moment. You know, they've got bibs around their necks. I mean, you can pretty much get them to say anything.
It's very true.
And of course, as you and I well know, Tori, and at ABC, the makeup artists are so fabulous, and so
the best in the business.
Right.
Jackie and Renee, we can
name. Right, and not
Tony
only
uses them.
Not
yeah.
yes,
yeah.
Tony depends on them.
And he says what happens in the makeup room stays.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
Sorry.
You know, it is a you can have those conversations and know that you're safe.
It's annoyingly so. Yeah. They are the two most
disgustingly discreet people
I have ever met in my life. And you feel like you're sitting there, it's the greatest therapy chair in the world. Mm-hmm. And they're just remarkable. I don't know if it was there. But it was during near the end of the O.J. Simpson trial, not for the verdict. But I don't know if you all remember this, but in the course of the O.J. Simpson trial, Marcia Clark's career was going up in flames.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Ito's career was, everybody, it was just a disaster for so many different ways. And I'm sitting in one chair, and Greta Van Susteren is sitting next to me. And this, she and her husband had this little tiny law firm, and then she became a talking head on the O.J. thing. And she and I are sitting there, we're watching something on the TV, and I said, boy, you know, has anybody's career done better as a result of this? And she looked at him and she goes,
mine.
There you went.
it's like one of my favorite stories. It's a true story in the family of somebody, you know, young person coming up to an older person in the family who was wearing a fur coat and said, who had to die for you to get that coat? And she said, my aunt.
Okay, speaking of family, Cokie, you have to tell me this if this is right. Mary Martha Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs?
Roberts.
It's been Roberts
for
52
years.
I know. But was that really your name?
Well, I pronounce it Corinne, but yes. But
why all those other names?
Well, you might be the youngest of five girls, but I'm a Catholic Southerner.
That's a lot, even by Catholic
You need
Southerners.
A patron saint. You need
exactly.
a confirmation saint.
Exactly.
I've been there.
And then all of the family going back generations. So, you know, there it is.
Wow. And somebody couldn't pronounce
Tommy,
Corinne.
My brother, who was 3 years older than I.
And that's how we got Cokie.
But Corinne is a very, very common New Orleans name, and I'm from New Orleans.
Yeah.
And no Saint Scarine, though. So
no, that's right. No Judy's, no, no Barbara's. Right, right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a Barbara.
Oh, is there a Barbara?
Oh, yeah. She was. She got,
she wasn't drummed out.
She got a rough ride. But but no. So
and a product of all girls' schools.
Yes, but so nicknames are very common because of there's so many Koreans.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And I lucked out because some of them are poochy and kooky and, you know, all that. So my mother's name was Corrine, and she was Lindy, you know, so right. It's right. So
how do you get Lindy from Corrine?
It's complicated.
Her father's, got a lot of wine cooking.
Her father's name was Roland, and the Creole of Roland is Rolandy.
Oh, you know, wow. So
there you go, Lindy.
And she looked just that? Like him.
So wow. How about that? Yeah.
Well, when I was quite young, and my older sisters were all torturing me because that's what they did, and I was really upset that I didn't have a middle name. And because they would find anything
I'd
to make
fun of me. I'd be happy to give you
right.
one.
No, wait. I came up.
Yeah, they, I got one right now.
I do have to give them credit. When my parents came home and announced they had this younger sister named Victoria, my older sisters were immediately horrified that they might have a sister named Vicky, which is how they came up with Tori, for which I am grateful.
Right. Yeah.
But I was sitting there one night at the dinner table on Sunday night, which is when we all had dinner together. And I liked, at the time, I loved cowboys and Indians. Because they had horses. So, right. And I didn't care which side, cowboys or Indians. But I announced that my middle name was going to be Indian. Took about 0.5
right
seconds.
In Hollywood today.
0.5 seconds for one of my sisters to go, Tori Indian Clark. Tick. Perfect. Tick. So Tick was it for quite some time.
Oh, no.
Quite some time, yeah. Maybe till I was 17 or 18.
Oh, God.
Okay, Koki, product of all girls' schools. How did that impact your decisions on what you wanted to do with your rest of your life, your work, the way you looked at work?
I'm sure that it did. I don't have anything to compare it with, but I was raised by Sacred Heart nuns who were incredibly keen to make sure that we could succeed at anything. They took girls very seriously in the 1950s, which was radical, and I always joke they raised us to be anything we wanted to be except priests, and they were bitter about that. But they've gotten more bitter since.
Oh, yeah.
But it was, I mean, there was no limit on expectations. And that was very unusual in that era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we have got a very good friend who's in admissions for high schools, woman. And she will only say, out of the school and out of work, she'll say, daughters, she wishes they would go to all-girls school, and boys have to go to co-ed because they need the socialization. But she really thinks all-girls schools are very valuable.
Well, what we've, you know, I mean, the data on it is that girls' schools produce leaders. And that even happened for a long time. I thought, well, once, you know, when I was in school, places like Yale and Princeton and stuff were not co-ed.
That's right.
But I thought once they went co-ed that would change, but it hasn't. Mm. And you still see women who succeed. Many, many, many of them come out of women's schools.
Nancy Pelosi is a perfect example
exactly.
of that.
And she will certainly say it.
Yes.
Did you like Wellesley?
Well, I liked it fine. I got an excellent education there. I made a set of wonderful friends who still are very close friends, and I met my husband of 52 years. So that, you know, that's all
pretty good.
I didn't like being in an environment of 18 to 22-year-olds. I missed old men with cigars, and I missed babies, and I missed, you know, college wasn't my milieu.
That might have happened at a co-ed school as well.
No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It was all about being with 18 to 22-year-olds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was raised in a political family. I was so used to the broad spectrum of America and of race. And, you know, I was raised in a deep South family where it was very pro-civil rights. And, you know, it was just a time that was so isolating for me. But as I say, I got an excellent education, uh-huh. made fabulous friends, and found a husband.
What caused you to go down a different path than the rest of your family? Because they were all politics all the time.
Well, I met Steve between our sophomore and junior years.
Where'd you meet him? I know him very well, too.
We were 18 and 19 years old, and we met at a student political convention, the
Excellent.
National Student Association. And he was always going to be a journalist, so it would have been very hard on him if I had gone into politics. But I've always felt guilty about not going into politics. I'm a great admirer of people who put their bodies on the line like that and serve the public. and get into the arena. I have tried to assuage my guilt a little bit by writing about politics, and I hope educating voters over the decades so that they can make decisions, you know, based on facts. What mm-hmm. a concept. Mm-hmm. and so that's made it a little bit better.
Did your family give you I've worked for Republicans most of my entire life, a lot of my entire life, and those same sisters constantly giving me so much grief, mm-hmm. right? Anything any Republican anywhere in the world did wrong was my fault. And I had to
well, sure.
it, right? And then you end up defending it. You find yourself defending journalists to your
no,
family?
No, I can't defend journalists.
Not all of them. Anyway.
I mean, I grew up with the same prejudices. You know? But my father and mother met on the college newspaper at Tulane. She was at Newcomb, he was at Tulane. Wow. And so he was the editor, she was the women's editor. And he did work for the New Orleans newspapers while he was in law school, so it wasn't a totally foreign concept to them.
Yeah, and they could give you lots of advice on how to do your job.
Excellent. They were actually quite good at that.
Yeah, my father still does. Okay, many, many, many books, including two with your dear husband, Steve Roberts, but almost all of them focusing on women.
Yes.
Women at the founding of this country, women in the Civil War. Why?
Why not? There are plenty of the other kind. I feel very strongly that history leaving out more than half of the human race is inaccurate history. Mm-hmm. It's not telling the whole story, and by not telling the whole story, you're not telling the story. And so I got interested in it, partly because I covered women in politics and women as voters and all of that, but also because I did grow up in a political family where I saw here in Washington in the 1950s the political wives running everything. I mean, they ran the conventions, they ran the voter registration drives, they ran their husbands' campaigns. It was before Home Rule. They worked with the African-American women here to run all the social service agencies and, of course, us kids. And so I knew how influential they were. And when you cover Congress and politics as long as I have, you get to be on a first-name basis with the founding fathers. And and so I started wondering about the women of the founding era. And
did you have an assumption before you started?
Well, I assumed they had to be as influential as the women, at least of my era. But I didn't have any documentation other than Abigail Adams saying to remember the ladies.
Right. And, which has become, didn't you say, the most influential, the most important line written by an American woman?
Probably.
Or spoken by an American woman.
She didn't speak it. She wrote it. I mean, she might have said it, too. And he just laughed at her, John Adams. Would have petticoat rule if you, all of that.
Well, he was obnoxious and disliked us.
That's so true. But she liked him. And she did like him.
From all of that research and understanding of those women, can you explain why there hasn't been a woman president?
Well, start with, could I explain why it took till 1920 to get the vote?
Right.
Mm. I mean, we're right. just about to celebrate the centennial. The centennial, I mean, that's pathetic. And, well, the answer is that men don't like to, no person likes to give up power. No creature. The dogs are not great at it either. that's what it requires. It requires giving up power.
But why, to Jeannie's point, why in some of these other countries where you wouldn't expect it?
Benazir
Bhutto. Right. I know a lot of Germans. I wouldn't have expected Angela Merkel. Right?
But thank God for her.
Thank God for her.
Sure.
But why in those countries? Why?
Often it's the difference between a parliamentary system and a presidential system. So, as you know, in a parliamentary system, you become the head of your party, and your party wins. And it's becoming more individualized than it used to be, but it's still the case. Yeah. And that's a much easier nut to crack than the singular role of the mm-hmm. president of the United mm-hmm. States.
Mm-hmm.
And
that electorate.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the main reason. It's also true that you look around at a lot of those women. It's not true of Merkel or Meyer, but it is certainly true of Bhutto and Gandhi and others. There was a man in their lives,
They weren't tokens.
No, not at all. But that was their path. Uh-huh. And one of the things I heard a lot in 2008 was from younger women particularly saying, you know, well, Hillary Clinton just got there because of Bill Clinton. And you know, first of all, that wasn't true. But secondly, that's not an illegitimate entryway into into politics.
Sure. There are a lot of more illegitimate ways into politics than that. Yeah, exactly. Right. Of the I mean, I love all your books. I've read all of them. But the Founding Mothers, the women who raised our nation, are my absolute favorite. So think about women who are running for office more. And there are more women in Congress now than ever before, which is a good thing. But think about and tell us about some of the wives of the Founding Fathers. What are the lessons, what are the inspiration current women could take from them? These flipping Martha Washington was on the battlefield sometimes.
Modern women are a bunch of sissies, you know. Honest to God. It's really
Mark, I think that's the title of our show.
It's really true, you know. People tell me, you know, I can't be expected to work full time and raise these children and, you know, and put on Christmas dinner. Well, why not? And you know, these women
really. You and I did our Thanksgiving dinner recipes while we're getting ready to take this week.
And I have to do both Hanukkah and Christmas.
Yeah.
And these women were leading 18th century lives. We're just getting through the day was difficult, right? And they were incredibly resourceful as they ran out of money. The men weren't being paid to think great thoughts and all that, but they also were just such admirable patriots, and that's the part that just strikes me between the eyes. You know, there you are. Take Abigail Adams, who wasn't the easiest person, but was fascinating. She's got four little kids. She's in the house the size of this table, and for those of you listening, this table is not large, and it really was a tiny house. She's trying to farm and collect her husband's law fees and all that. And oh, by the way, the British are coming. At one point, honest to God, this is such classic John Adams. At one point, he writes to her and says, if it gets really dangerous, take our children and fly to the woods.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks, John. You know, hope you're having a nice dinner in Philadelphia. But she would sit down at the end of a day like that by candlelight and write these letters that are just remarkable and very thoughtful about the kind of government that we should be having and all that. And, of course, furious that they hadn't declared independence much earlier, you know, you lily-livered men. And
They were a consistent thread with the correspondence we do have. And I want you to talk about Martha Washington and why she burned all her letters, was get on with it.
Get on with it.
Right. Why is this taking so long? Right. All these kinds of things. They were very, very impatient. And they did, in addition to just trying to raise the kids and everything else, they were out there and they were supporting soldiers and they were writing letters.
Well, some of them were taken hostage and killed. And you're right about Martha Washington. Every winter, we know about Valley Forge, but every winter of the 8 long years of the Revolutionary War, she went to camp. She hated it. Yeah. She'd go over dangerous roads. She was a prime target for hostage taking. But the general felt that she was necessary to morale.
Yeah.
And of course, there were lots of times when troops were threatening desertion by regiment because they were unpaid, unfed, all of that. And she would come in from Mount Vernon, where she had been over the summer, and with one of the many contributions of African Americans to the Revolution, she'd have her carriage filled with foodstuffs that had been pickled and canned and cloth that had been woven and all of that at Mount Vernon. And she'd be cheered into camp. Lady Washington is here. And they loved her. And she would nurse the soldiers, cook for the soldiers, pray with the soldiers. And then they'd put on entertainments for them all the time.
Yeah.
And all that. And which was a good thing she was there, though, because George could be indiscreet and did dance for 3 hours straight with the very flirty.
Really?
Yes, Katie Green, Nathaniel Green's wife. Yeah.
He put his fake teeth in.
Why am I surprised? I don't know.
She was a piece of work. Right. Well, that's what Martha Washington called She called her Tomcat Hamilton.
Yeah. Is that
no, it's totally true.
Is it true? Because
totally
I've heard
true.
It's not true.
No,
it's true. It's not true.
Totally true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We have contemporaneous accounts.
All right.
Hey. So she did have a sense of humor, despite that stupid little cap on her head. But, you know, speaking of women's letters, and you're right, Tori, she did burn.
But
we believe that she did.
We believe that she did, but why?
Probably because they were private in her mind, and also there's some sense that she probably spelled badly and her grammar wasn't great and all that. We do have some letters, though, before she married Washington, when she became the widow Park Custis, therefore the wealthiest woman in Virginia.
Yeah.
She was doing business with the English suppliers, and those letters seem fine to me. But at any rate, she did it, or somebody did it. We don't have them, which is terrible, because the other great reason to write women's history is that women's letters are so, so, so much better than men's letters.
Yes.
I mean, the men...
self-revealing.
Well, exactly, and they're society-revealing. I mean, the men knew they were doing something important, and so their letters were studied and pompous and edited and all of that.
Ponderous.
Right. The women just wrote letters. They didn't know I'd be reading their mail, you know, a couple hundred years later.
Right.
And so they talk about politics, yes, a lot of politics, but also who's having and all too often losing babies, what the fashions are, what
how the crops are doing,
exactly,
while you're
the
off
economic situation, all of that.
Yeah.
And then there are also always some just wonderful, you know, little tales.
There's a great little book. I should have looked it up before the show. I think it was called The Last Ride, and it was about after the war is over. And Washington is supposed to be getting his you-know-what back to Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been gone for so long, and she would be sleeping up there and things. And she wanted him home, but he's got to do the last ride from New York or whatever. And along the way, all the people, including all those who were loyalists 2 days before, having party after party after party. And he and Martha are riding back and forth, and he'd go on and on about how great this is in the new country. She's like, yeah, get your butt back to Mount Vernon. I'm sick of doing this on my own. They're very practical in a lot of those letters.
Well, they had to be practical.
Yeah. Okay, 100 years from now, can anybody write books like these, Cokie? Because nobody writes letters anymore.
Well, so my advice is save your emails. You can print them out on recycled paper, but if you really look at emails, particularly around weddings, deaths, people going off to college, whatever, they tell a family story. They really do. And they might not be beautifully written, but a lot of our history wasn't beautifully written. I mean, one of my favorites was when Steve and I did the marriage book, we did a chapter on pioneer marriage. And there was a woman who grew up in Maine, always wanted to be a missionary, had to marry a missionary to become a missionary. And she and her husband left from St. Louis to go to Oregon. Now, think of this trip, right?
I don't like going to Northern Virginia,
only airports.
Right, only for the airport.
Don't go across those bridges.
Right. So, you know, they have to ride across the country. Of course she has a baby on the way, you know, all of that.
And, 3 years.
Right. they get to Oregon. And, you know, they set up a mission. And she writes one day in her diary, was up at 5, baked 9 loaves of bread, taught the school, was delivered of a son. And, and you say, this is a tweet, you know? I mean, but you get the picture.
Yeah. You understood what was going on.
And she didn't conquer world peace, in addition to all of that, somehow.
Okay, favorite founding mother?
You know, I'm never good at this, even about modern people. They were all different, you know. So you'd love to sit down to dinner with Sally Jay, so Sarah Livingston Jay, John Jay's wife. She was just a treat, and her letters are delightful, and apparently she was also a good cook. But and you'd love to sort of have an intellectual conversation with Abigail Adams, and you'd love to be entertained by Dolly Madison. You know, they're just different from each other. Dolly Madison, though, is a really not sung enough heroine. I said once to George H.W. Bush, you know, the unsung heroines, the first ladies. He said, Barbara is sung.
That's a great comeback.
Which is great.
But you thought they were kind of similar, other than having been both wife of and father, mother of, right?
That was Abigail and Barbara. Kind of, yes, that's many similarities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Dolly Madison, you can make a case, held this country together at a time when it was so young and so fragile. Mm-hmm. And the partisan differences and the regional differences were threatening to tear it apart. And she just made people come together, show up at her squeezes, and, you know, 'cause that's where the information got traded and the deals got made. And she just forced them to behave.
Yeah.
And got the country through a perilous time.
There's you'd have to go out through Northern Virginia, but you get to Montpelier, Madison's home, which has gone through a fascinating de-renovation, essentially. They put it back to the way it was
and
when he was there.
And it is beautiful.
It is beautiful. And they're really trying to do a good job on the real history of the place and the history of the family. Well, and one of those amazing stories is Dolly ends her stepson, spends all the money.
He was horrible.
But she ends up essentially penniless. Here in D.C., one of their former slaves ends up taking care of her. He was at the Department of Commerce and had a job, and he took care of her.
Daniel Webster had freed him, and he had very mixed emotions about the Madisons, but he did take care of Dolly Madison when she needed it. But Montpelier has done a wonderful job about the enslaved people, and because they found something highly unusual, which was a village right outside the main house.
That's right.
And usually, you know, it's the street down away from the big house. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's right there. And there's a lot of discussion about whether this was some experiment of Madison's and in democratization or something. But at any rate, they've done tremendous work on the archaeology of it, and it's fascinating. It's really good.
Yeah, it's absolutely great.
Actually, all those homes, Mount Vernon, Monticello, and Montpelier, have really stepped up to the plate to deal with the question of slavery, and to deal with to very much welcome the mm-hmm. descendants of the enslaved families, mm-hmm. and to not pretend that this wasn't a huge part of the history.
Yeah, it's a much more interesting conversation now. Okay, one of my New Year's resolutions to Mark has been, I will not let these shows go on for an hour and a half like I normally do, but I'm going to read, Cokie's got so many books, read them all, get them all, including the ones with Steve. We'll have him on sometime.
All right.
But this is going to be a quiz for everybody else at the table other than Cokie, and then Cokie, you have to join us at the end of the show. We do if you had to take one book to the desert/deserted island. Okay, but I'm going to read a quote, and you guys have to decide if you know who wrote this. Let's see. Okay, it was the end of the war. Nor would I rob
which war?
Revolutionary.
Revolutionary. Sorry.
Just checking.
Nor would I rob the fair sex of their share in the glory of a revolution so honorable to human nature. For indeed, I think you ladies are in the number of the best patriots America can boast.
Ben Franklin.
I'll say Thomas Paine.
Jeannie.
This is hard.
Michael, you can shout in. Michael's Googling it right now.
That kind of takes the sport out of
it.
I'll
say Ben Franklin. I like Ben Franklin.
Oh, Ben Franklin hated women.
He was a cad.
He was horrible. He was horrible.
Oh, my God.
He was terrible.
I think of him as so...
Go ahead, Cokie.
Intellectual.
It was George Washington.
Yay.
Yay. Georgie.
And he wrote that to...
fascinating woman.
Yes. Boudinot Stockton. I'm blanking on her first
name.
Annis. Thank you. Annis Boudinot Stockton. She was a great poet and a propagandist for the Americans, published all over America.
This at is the time, 18th which is
century,
incredible.
Right. And her husband, Richard Stockton, who's the person who for some reason is celebrated, which I don't understand, was one of the signers, I think the only signer of the Declaration of Independence, who then reneged. He was taken captive. And, you know, and she then lived out the war on her own in Princeton. And at one point, the Congress was there because they were constantly escaping the British. And she rented her house out, you know, to Congress people. That didn't work well for her. but she was quite an influential person in her own right, and the president recognized that.
He had a little correspondence going with her. Just literary. Okay. Mark, we're going to start with you.
Oh, books on a deserted island?
Yes, sir.
In honor of Jack London, I'm going to go with Martin Eden. Read it a long time ago.
Yeah, that was mine.
Well, you can still, it's all right. We can share it.
No, because I had never heard of it. You know, I never got past, you know, Fang.
I read it a long time ago.
But then I read about it and thought, this is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely worth the read. It's sort of a semi-autobiographical account of his life, but it's like a struggling writer, and it's funny because he was a socialist, but it's more about an individualist kind of attitude, which he sort of thought was fun. To sort of have that sort
of amazing guy.
Yeah, and his life, it really was remarkable, and it's fascinating reading. It's kind of a tough ending, but I won't spoil it for you. But
David,
I'm torn because Jeannie had mentioned Lorne Michaels and the Miller Shales book on Saturday Night Live is fantastic.
Very, very good.
It's unbelievably good.
Do you know Tom Shales? God bless him. I worked at Comcast when he was the TV critic of the Post. He would call me up every 3 weeks and complain about his cable service. I work for the Cable TV Association. He would call up every few weeks. I go, you really shouldn't be doing this, you know. And he would do it anyway.
I have a story about Tom Shales. He was at the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winning.
Are we the only people who have not won Pulitzer Prizes?
No, exactly. Very bitter about it. So Tom Shales is somebody that I not only read, but he went to American University.
That's
he's an AU. He's one of the proud American University graduates.
Fly, Eagles, fly.
And so, that's not at all what we say, but it's okay. For the bit, I'll go along with it.
Thank you.
So, I'm getting on the escalator, or the elevator, I'm sorry, one day, going up to the fifth floor at the Post, and he gets on with me.
Did you say hello, and he refused to acknowledge you?
I said, you know, Mr. Shales, we have something in common. We were both editors-in-chief of the Eagle, the student newspaper at the American University. To which he went,
Is that a direct quote?
That's a direct quote.
Nice. Gracious to him.
Thanks, Tom.
Nice. Jeannie?
I am rereading The World According to Garp.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Oh, good one.
Good one.
It is amazing. Great. That book was published in 1978. That was his fourth novel.
He had a good run.
It is about a feminist single woman who has a child, Garp. There is a transsexual in this. There is a
makes me want to read it again.
There is a radical women's group. I mean, it is so prescient in so many ways, and like also sort of crazy.
There's
but
stuff
I'm
in
really,
that book.
Really enjoying it.
Stuff.
Excellent, Cokie.
Well, I wasn't prepared for this.
I know. You're a journalist,
but I do tend to read when we're talking fiction. Southern writers more than others, and
you and Mary Madeline,
I would have to say the moviegoer, Walker Percy. Percy's the moviegoer.
Oh, good one.
It's a really spectacular,
really good one,
terrific book.
Look who's here!
Look who walked in.
Who's here?
But I might say Little Women.
I think Little Women inspired a lot of people.
Oh yeah,
a whole lot of people.
Absolutely.
I love that. Okay, speaking of inspiring, so Cookie, we could go on for hours about how many awards you've won. These books that you've written, all of which are fabulous. And thank you for doing it. Thank you for being with us.
Oh,
but thank you for doing all that.
Thank you for a nice glass of wine.
Absolutely. There's more out there. Yes. And little housekeeping, we're going dark for a couple of weeks. I'm going to Vietnam.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Now, the last time I was in Vietnam with my then boyfriend, now husband, we were detained by the Vietnamese government for a week. We're looking for something a little less interesting this time. But then we'll be back in February, and we've got some great guests, so I can't remember, but we'll put that out soon.
Stay tuned.
Who we got coming
drink
up.
A lot of this.
We got. But thank you, everybody, very much for being here.
Thank
Happy
you
New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
time.